Hey, what's up, everybody? My name is Kate, and you're listening to This Australian Life, around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Joy 94.9. So you might be used to hearing Lisa from Word From Word each week, which it's on a break right now from production, but I hope you stay tuned as I chat with people from around Australia on who they are and where they are in 2020. This week, two stories. First, a long, in-depth interview with my friend Cherie, and second, stories from Corona, part two. I interview two Australians trapped in Peru, what their thoughts are, and how they're coping. But first, Cherie. This week, we're talking with my good friend Cherie. She's had an awesome life, originally born in Brisbane, but raised in the west side of Auckland. She's been to art school, she's taught all over the world. She's had a good life, but more importantly, she's learned a lot along the way. Like what it's like to work with kids. You know, especially those tough kids that just aren't getting it, or what it's like to date someone in Egypt. I don't know, cool stuff. I hope you enjoy.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, thanks for doing this. You're my first This Australian Life interview over the phone, so welcome. Yeah. Where are you right now?
I'm in my room, which is the attic in my house. So I've got one window, and that's where my desk is. My cat is sitting right in front of me, but I'm not allowed to touch her.
Why can't you touch her?
She's a cat. As much as I tried to tell myself at one stage that cats were trainable, they're not trainable.
What gave you the idea cats are trainable?
I just thought because I could make her stand up to eat treats, and because, like, she knows that 9 o'clock-ish is bedtime, so she'll, like, come inside or put herself to bed. So I guess I had this idea that I had trained her to do those things.
I like this concept that we think people in our life, things in our life, are doing things because of us. Because we like them. But how many things do people do just because they like them? And we're just along for the ride.
I'm Cherie. I'm a 38-year-old cis woman. I would identify as bi, gay, not sure, questioning. So I was born in Brisbane. I grew up in Auckland in New Zealand. In West Auckland, actually. And the most of my childhood was in New Lynn, the mean streets of New Lynn. I used to go to Lynn Mall all the time. Just loved going to the mall all the time because that's what we did. Honestly, West Auckland just has a reputation for being full of bogans, right? So if you said you were from West Auckland, people were like, bogan.
So growing up in New Lynn, you were bogan?
Yes.
Tell me more about that.
We probably weren't bogans because I think we probably thought we were better than other families in New Lynn.
Does anyone ever think they're bogan?
And we didn't have a Holden out the front up on bricks. That would have been real bogan. Purple velvet dresses and black hair and, yeah, that sort of stuff.
As an American, I like these descriptions of what are obviously stereotypes about what it means to be poor and to have bad taste because I guess our stereotypes in America are so different. A purple velvet dress sounds really nice to me.
There was a stage in my teens where I would have been a bit bogan, so that would have been with my younger sister's friends in their Holdens, because they were into Holdens, not Fords. And, yeah, just, like, cruising, doing laps, just driving around. Saturday night, drive around the city, drive out to Mission Bay, just driving.
Do you look back on that time fondly?
More now. Like, I used to just cringe and hate it. Hate that I was, like, a wastie, in quotations. No, I don't hate it so much now.
Why do you feel like you used to have that scorn?
I think I was just embarrassed that I came from West Auckland. Like, I wanted to be somebody else. And, you know, like, when I went to university, I guess the majority of people that were at university were actually more likely to be from, like, central or north in suburbs, they were kind of a lot wealthier, so I didn't really want to be somebody from a poor and, you know, Bogan suburb. I'm quite far removed from the person who grew up on West Auckland. Actually, I quite like that part of me that is a little bit rougher. Whoops. It's probably not a word I like to use. My friends that I went to school with and stuff from West Auckland, is that they were just kind of more real, more genuine and quite straight up. I like that. I see that in me too, and although I can be quite blunt, and that's something that I work on, often I don't think for long enough before I speak. Or, like, if I do give it any consideration before I think, I, like, give it the once over, and I think, yeah, that's fine. And then it comes out of my mouth, and it's, you know, could have been gentler.
So did you feel like your whole family was not meant to be where you were, or did you feel like it was just you?
You know, it was just like a stopover. I guess that was the impression that I got, that, like, living in Newlyn, in that house, it was kind of, it was a step on the way up.
And are they still there?
No. Nobody lives in Newlyn.
So has your mom stepped up? Has your dad stepped up? Was that just a stopping over point for them?
Well, my parents divorced, so there were obviously financial implications for both of them in that. That's as much as I'm going to tell you there.
Okay, cool. Message received. At this point, I make the point to Sheree that she's probably one of the more well-spoken people that I know. And she has, by and large, some of the more sophisticated tastes of people I know. She likes art, design, fashion, not exactly what you might think of as Bogan. I ask her if she's interested in things in part because she's trying to separate herself from where she's come from, or if she has a genuine interest that evolved entirely separate from all of this.
A bit of both. Really wanted to go to art school. In the art room, that's where I felt the most successful. My teachers see potential in me, and they would tell me that constantly. And they'd be like, you know, if you worked harder, you could be really great. And that didn't inspire me to work harder. That just, like, I was just like, yeah, I could be great.
So relatable. Who hasn't heard that they could be great at something and confuse that feeling with actually being great?
So I really wanted to go to this particular art school because it had the reputation for being the best art school in New Zealand, and I wanted people to think that I was great. Like, before I went to art school, all I really wanted to do was kind of draw and paint realistically. And then I got to art school and I realized that I actually wasn't very good at that. Like, I was good, but I wasn't great or excellent. For a little bit there, I felt a bit, like, lost. But what I did develop was a love for concepts and putting things together, thinking about composition and colour and all of those things. I didn't really push myself. I was quite terrified of stepping outside of my comfort zone in my teens and through a lot of my 20s. And also, I find it quite hard to just sit with one thing. I sewed, I painted, I drew, I did photography, I did stuff with clay, and I didn't think that was great. That made me inferior because I didn't have a discipline. I didn't have a disciplined practice. I felt like they wanted me to come out of art school like a painter or a sculptor or a printmaker, and that didn't really work for me.
I relate to this a lot. This idea that we're all supposed to be the best at whatever we do, but that's much harder if we like a lot of stuff. I don't know if anyone has ever won the Olympics in two different disciplines. The world's best horseback rider is just probably not going to be killing it at hockey.
You know, after I finished art school, I did teacher training because I wanted a job, and I didn't really know what else to do. I went into teaching, and actually while I was doing that, I learned a lot about my own creative practice.
Hi everyone, just wanted to take the time to remind you that you're listening to Joy 94.9, and this is This Australian Life. We're talking with Sheree, who is 38 years old, lives in Melbourne, and she's had an amazing life. She's been a teacher all over the world, and now she's telling us about how she went from humble beginnings, growing up in the west side of Auckland, to one of the best art schools in New Zealand.
When I was in my early 20s, I didn't want to travel. a lot of people around me wanted to travel, but I wanted to want to travel. I had to teach in New Zealand for 2 years before I could go overseas, just so I could have my teaching registration. I moved to London. I had friends there already. I found a really cool place in Battersea. Battersea was beautiful, but I didn't really love that part of London too much. I didn't really identify with the people or the fashion. It's superficial.
You didn't like the way they dressed?
No, I didn't. Also, like, I wanted to live in what I thought was a cooler part of town, and what I think most people would think is a cooler part of town. I was in Battersea, and I did relief teaching, like supply teaching, so I just go into, you know, for the day. And I was secondary trained in New Zealand, so I was a secondary art teacher. And when I got to London, I decided I won't do secondary relief teaching. Mostly because I didn't want to deal with the behaviour management of teenagers in London. I'd heard rumours about how much harder they were than they were in New Zealand. And then I soon discovered that even primary school children in London, at the schools I was going to, there were some really difficult situations to deal with. I really had to spruik myself, because I'd call my agents every day, because that's what they said, call us and we'll get you on for work. And so I'd call them every day, and like, I remember saying to one of my agents, like, can you please send me back to that school? And he was like, oh, we try to send as many people, different people as possible. And I was like, okay, like, I understand that, and you want to get a bunch of people work. But I decided to, like, I wanted to take matters into my own hands. So when I was at school, I would go in to whoever was in charge of the relief teachers and, like, thank them for the day, introduce myself again, and tell them that if they liked how I'd worked and they wanted me back, to ask for me. And that really worked in my favour. So I ended up getting some longer-term placements at some schools, like 6 weeks here and then 2 weeks there, and then I ended up being offered a year-long position in a primary school. And, like, obviously I was out of my depth, like, I'm not primary school trained. And I know that you can go up and down, like, that's the deal with education, is that if you're secondary trained, you can generally do primary, and if you're primary trained, I think you can go up to year 7 or 8 or something. I just didn't really enjoy teaching primary school subjects. I really enjoyed the kids because they really helped me to loosen up. I could be silly around them. I found that quite difficult for a while. Leading up, you know, before that, I found it quite, I guess I was a little bit uptight. So, for example, with one really beautiful class that I taught in London, we had to come up with a dance for this end of year production. So they gave us a song, and then everybody just kind of bounced some ideas around, and we all just kind of, including me, were like, just test out little silly dances. What about this one? What about this one? And yeah, I just would have been too concerned about how I look. Yep. Teaching primary school, everything. Except I've worked out this deal with another teacher who's in the same year group with me, where she teaches my PE class last thing on a Friday and I teach her art class last thing on a Friday, which is fabulous for both of us because she really loves PE. She's like the fastest runner I've ever met, and she always really enjoyed whooping the parents' butts in the parent-teacher race at the school Olympics. But yeah, I was out of my depth with English and science and maths. You know, nobody can just walk into a teaching job. That is essentially what I did. What they asked me to do a year because they knew I was good with the kids, with behavior management, and I had a good rapport with the kids. I had some good strategies for defusing conflict and for helping them take responsibility for their stuff, showing them different ways of behaving if they were really struggling.
I feel like, from what I've heard, from when you talk about it, you have kind of like a fondness for kids with behavior problems. Is that right?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I could see when students were trust, as could many other teachers, by the way. This is not, you know, I'm not unique in this way. Scared, probably really, really sad about maybe some stuff that's happened in their past, and people bring that to school. You can't expect people to kind of, especially children and young adults, to compartmentalize their lives and you know, leave half of themselves at home when they come to school. I identified things in them that I thought I could help to work through. And, you know, I did that in the best way that I can. Now, obviously, I didn't do anything perfectly. I know that I helped some kids, and it feels really beautiful when you help, when you see people progress. Like, academically, it's really beautiful, you know, when you see somebody improve, especially when everything's against them. You know, they're not groomed to learn. But it's also really beautiful when you see them soften up and grow, you know, emotionally. I've registered to be a teacher again, but I know I'm going to need to complete some tasks probably, because I haven't taught in the last 5 years, because I've been studying and working.
That's really exciting.
It is.
If you're just tuning in, my name is Kate, and you're listening to This Australian Life on Joy 94.9. We're talking with Cherie, my friend, a 38-year-old cisgendered woman living in Melbourne. She's been a teacher all over the world, went to art school, and now we're about to learn a little bit about how she found herself teaching in Egypt after a year-long stint in a school in London. Stay tuned.
I start looking for another role, but I've decided at this stage that I want to be, I want an experience. I want to be challenged. I want a cultural experience. Because when I got to London, I was really looking for work. I'd signed up to countless teaching agencies. I was getting emails regularly about roles, and one popped into my inbox about an art teacher role in Egypt. And so I went along for that interview. I was offered the job, and then actually I found out not long afterwards, when I was talking to a friend about it, that my friend had actually gotten that role, and then she changed her mind about going to Egypt, so they re-advertised, and then I got it. Yeah, so I went to Cairo, and I did get a cultural experience. I really was chucked in the deep end. I had an assumption, and, you know, maybe other people made this assumption too, that when I moved to London, it would be very similar to New Zealand, but actually it was very different culturally. Like, the Brits were quite different. And would you like me to give you an example of that?
Absolutely.
It is the greeting, which is, you're right, you're right. It doesn't mean, are you all right? It just means, hey. It took me a really long time to realize it just meant, hey, and that people weren't actually inquiring as to my well-being or how I was going, or if I looked concerned. They just meant, hey.
So were you giving long answers to, like...
Yeah, I'd be like, oh, I don't know, I guess. And I'd be like, oh, just trying to edge out of the conversation.
Would you say that that is also a greater reflection of maybe, like, British people not wanting to get to know you, like, they wouldn't actually want to ask that question? And would you say New Zealanders might actually want to get to know you, to say, oh yeah, like, how are you going?
I think it's less about New Zealanders and Londoners, and more about busy, heaving cities and small countries.
I'm not going to lie, we probably talked about that for way too long.
Yeah, I don't even know where it's come from. You're right.
But eventually we got back to Egypt.
I like to Google map a country before I visit. just to have a look. So I often did like a Google Street View. I wanted to see what cities that I was going to would look like. And usually I would do that when I had to, say, get transport from the airport to the bus terminal, from the bus terminal to my hostel. So I'd look at the street view so I could see markers and stuff for where I'd need to go. And there might be now, but there wasn't at the time Google Street View of Egypt. So, but there were heaps of pictures that people had dropped in onto the map, so you could click on those and have a look around. So I felt like I was prepared for what it was going to look like, and I don't know what I was thinking. It was just stupid. Lots of people in burqas, and I was like, okay, or niqabs, sorry, and hijabs. And there were a few burqas too. I was like, all right, so I felt pretty prepared. And then I got to Egypt, and it was really, really beautiful. The color palette was, in London, it's quite grey, just overall, like lots of concrete and lots of grey. And I am talking about London city. Everything in Egypt kind of had this yellowish hue. It was really beautiful. The sun was super bright in summer, and like all through the city, everything was kind of covered in dust, sand. There was all this beautiful French architecture and really inspiring, and I really enjoyed that. I know Egypt was the top of my travel list, so to live there was like super exciting.
Can you imagine to finally go and live in the place you've always dreamed of? But then it is another thing entirely when you actually start living there and the dream starts to become the reality.
Got to do lots of exciting stuff and, you know, see the pyramids and all of that. It made going to see other ruins in other countries a bit underwhelming. I taught in an international school in Cairo. Looking back, I can, like, laugh about stuff, but I did find it quite stressful at the time.
Can you guess what I'm going to ask?
I'll tell you one thing that was stressful, was that I think it was in the second year, they changed the way that you could get things done around the school. So there was one guy who kind of ran this whole maintenance area, and so you know, you could say, hey, can you fix something here or turn the water back on in my classroom? It was constantly being turned off in the art rooms, drove me mental. Put this thing in the second year where you couldn't just go and ask him to fix something, which is understandable. You don't want 100 teachers coming up to you just willy-nilly. So you had to fill out a form and you had to take it down to the office and you had to put it into this in tray. And I always wanted to put it directly in his hands because sometimes, you know, the piece of paper just got lost and, you know, he hadn't received it and that's why it hadn't been done. And so I'd always be like, put, you know, here, take this. And so yeah, if it didn't get lost, you'd have a worker knock on your door, your classroom door at some point, and then they would do the task that had been told to them to do. And so it's summer, it's 42 degrees outside, and your air conditioning in your class is set on like 24, which is way too hot. So, or maybe like 28. And so you said, like, hey, could you turn the air conditioning down? Because they took all the air conditioning remotes, so we couldn't do it ourselves. which felt a little bit like being micromanaged. But anyway, so this guy shows up and he's got a remote and he goes to change your air conditioning, but instead of turning it down, he turns it up. And you're like, no, down, down. And he's like, oh, you know, because I didn't speak very much Egyptian Arabic and they spoke little or no English, and so you'd be trying to communicate, no, please turn it down, and they'd be saying like, I've been told to turn it up, and you'd be like, please turn it down, it's hot, and they'd be like, sorry, and you just have to fill out another form. So then you'd have to fill out a form again and take it back down and put it in the in tray, or try to get it into this dude's hands, and then wait another couple of days for someone to come up with the remote and hope that they turned it to the temperature that you wanted it on. Yeah, so that was insanely frustrating.
your issues, were they mostly with just the school that you were at? Or was there stuff about living in Egypt in particular that was really trying?
There were some things at the school that were very trying. And there were some things, I guess, day to day that were quite difficult. On the bus rides home from the school, you could keep the curtains open if you wanted. But, yeah, you would have truckloads of dudes. And I do mean a truckload. It's like a mini truck and it's full of dudes. And they're all on their way home from work or something. And they're all, you know, heaps of them in the back would be, like, doing kisses at you and, like, bumping their index fingers together and being like, you and me. You know, that was kind of amusing until it wasn't amusing. And then you need a holiday. Time. Just close the curtains, really.
Would they do this type of behavior with Egyptian women, or is it just because you're a Westerner?
If an Egyptian woman was dressed the way that we were dressed, i.e., you know, you could see their forearms, and or they weren't veiled, wandering around the streets on their own, maybe.
You said earlier you're like, talking about your decision to move to Egypt and work there, said you were stupid. Do you mind just clarifying what you meant by that?
My ideas about, you know, what a destination is going to look like. I actually think I had, like, ideas of Goshenyi and Buddhism. And realistically, they're probably quite racist. I can't really remember the content, but they were set in Egypt, I think, or in the Middle East. So I think in my mind I was like, oh, it's going to be quite primitive. It's going to be like stepping back in time. There were certainly places we visited where the streets in and around Egypt, where the streets were, you know, like dirt streets and beautiful small concrete huts. Most part, like Cairo is like a bustling built-up city. Just, I was just ignorant.
Did you date anyone in Egypt?
Yes.
Did you date, like, an Egyptian?
I did.
Tell me about it.
Dated two Egyptians.
Continue.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. Like, they could take me places that I wouldn't know to go because they were local.
Was there a big cultural difference?
I mean, there's probably a big cultural difference between you and I. Sure, there's always going to be, but one of the people I dated there was, he worked as he owns a tour company, so he organizes tours in and around Egypt and also outside of Egypt, so around the Middle East, but also I know in recent years he'd organized trips to Europe and stuff, so it's not like I was dating somebody who hadn't been exposed to Western culture before. And then the other person that I dated was working for a French company and had done a lot of travel in and around Europe and lived in quite an affluent suburb in Cairo. So I guess kind of mingled with a lot of Westerners. So I certainly wasn't dating anybody that I met these people in social situations.
Yeah, you didn't like date the dude who's like selling you fruit.
Exactly. Well, obviously we both like fruit.
Yeah. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, Egyptian culture, obviously, any Arabic culture has certain views of women that no matter what you do, no matter if you are very, very modern or very, very progressive, like, it must have trickled down, I'm guessing, somehow in your relationship that women had a different role than, say, maybe, like, a more westernized society.
I guess the way that I look at that is, I feel like we often come to this discussion with a West is best viewpoint when we talk about equality. And I would say better, and obviously it varies depending on which country you're in. Did I grow up in a country that had more liberal ideas about what women could be? Yes. But I certainly still felt restricted in that country too. Yeah. I did feel sometimes restricted in other countries.
So I guess you never felt like, you know, if something went further with these relationships, that basically they would expect you to, once you got married, stay at home or anything like that. Like, they just weren't, they weren't that way about women and relationships at all.
I didn't really date either of them for long enough to know what their expectations of wives would be. I couldn't really answer that.
Cool. So, moving on, what made you decide to leave Egypt?
I went to Egypt in 2011, which was just after the revolution. It was a bit hectic. There were no police around for the first year, and then I guess there were still lots of demonstrations, and it felt unstable. Like, the reality is like my friend and I had gone to, you know, the beautiful big market in the city. I'm going to slaughter this pronunciation. Khan al-Khalili. Awful KH just then. But anyway, and on our way home, we found ourselves trapped because there was an enormous demonstration. So our taxi just kind of had to drive through it. So that was a bit scary. Like, nothing happened to us. Just like a little bit of jostling of the taxi. But we were okay, you know, but it didn't feel that stable.
My name is Kate, and you're in Joy 94.9 and listening to This Australian Life. If you're just joining us, we're chatting up a storm with my friend Cherie. She's taught all over the world, and now we listen as she leaves Egypt and tells us about her next stop in teaching. She moves to Singapore.
My friend, who had been teaching at the same school as me, had stayed for 2 years, and she'd been there a year before me. So in my second year, when I said I moved up to secondary school art, I took over her role, and she got a job in Singapore with her partner. And so when I was back in London, she contacted me and said that there was a role at her partner's school for a maternity cover for an art teacher, and that I should go for the job. So I was very, very lucky. And so, yeah, they couldn't actually find anybody in Singapore. I was super, super lucky there. I got a job and I moved to Singapore. And I went ballistic, wearing short shorts for the first, because I could bare my skin without feeling like I was being disrespectful. I don't feel like I would feel that comfortable wearing short shorts now, but yeah, I went ballistic wearing short shorts in Singapore.
So you got to Singapore and you love it?
Oh, yeah. Everything was clean, because, you know, Singapore's got like a billion rules, and it's super, super clean. And the green, like, it's really tropical. Again, super beautiful. And the greenery in Singapore is insane. It's like the surreal forest, but super saturated, vibrant green. It's excellent. So yeah, when that finished up, I moved to Melbourne.
What were like your feelings in like all these places? Like, how are you doing like emotionally? Like, you go from London to Egypt to Singapore.
Everywhere I've moved felt exciting and full of opportunity, and everywhere, you know, the shine kind of wears off. Like, I felt that everywhere I went. I mean, the thing that's different about Melbourne is I've been here for 5.5 years, so I've just stayed here. When I was living abroad, yeah, I always knew that, like, I wasn't going to live there.
And what was it about Melbourne that made you decide to stay?
It had a really good vibe. You know, there were heaps of bars and heaps of cafes and restaurants, and it has delivered on what I wanted out of Melbourne. There is heaps on. Like, I don't go out every night, but if I wanted to, I could.
And where does that bring us now? What are you doing now?
Well, it's coronavirus central. So my...
I guess, what are your plans? Like, you know...
I'm thinking quite carefully about teaching council in Victoria so that I can look at art teaching jobs here. Well, it's quite hard to anticipate where the supply and demand for jobs right now. So I'm quite confident that there will be few roles in the fashion industry and that it'll be extremely competitive. And I'm conscious of the fact that I have very little experience. I guess I'm just thinking about playing to my strengths.
Another question, just emotionally, how have you developed over the years?
My feelings are that as I've gotten older, my life has gotten better. In my 30s, I cared a lot less about what people thought of me than I did in my 20s and obviously in my teens. I actually remember somebody that I taught with in Auckland. She was turning 40-something. She had her birthday, and I said to her, this is a good example of me being blunt. And I was like, 42? Oh, my God. and she wasn't offended. And she said that her 40s were better than her 30s and that her 30s had been better than her 20s. I remember feeling like, oh, because when I was in my 20s, I thought, this is it, I've made it. My 20s are my best years. They will be my best years, but actually, my life has gotten better and better as I've gotten older. And I guess I'm a lot happier than I used to be. I have way more gratitude for just day-to-day life, really. And I guess that means, I've got lower expectations. Not in a negative way, just more realistic and just happier with what I've got.
When you originally went to art school, you said you wanted to draw really realistically, but you weren't that good at it, or you didn't think that you were that good at it, or you found out you weren't that good at it. So...
That one.
Yeah. Do you think you'll go back to it? Like, is that something that's ever crossed your mind?
Oh, I still like to draw, but I don't have the patience for it. It was better for me at the time to have moved away from that anyway, because I was so obsessed with doing things perfectly. I was trying to draw people perfectly. Really, I don't have those skills. That's kind of okay.
Awesome. Anything that you'd like to add that you feel like we didn't cover?
Nope.
It was too quick.
Busting for a wee.
What'd you say?
I said I am busting for a wee.
All right.
And I'll leave it with that. Next up, a story from Corona, part 2. We'll head right into it as I interview Em and Andrew, two Australians who are trapped in Peru. Have a listen and enjoy. Hello, my name is Kate, and this is Stories from Corona, part 2. This week we talk with two Australians stranded in Peru. But first, I wanted to start out this episode with a story of my own. So much has changed from last week, when I recorded two stories, one from New York City and one from a young woman stranded between Australia and the plan she'd had. You see, this morning I went to go get coffee, and I might not be able to do that by the time I record next week. I ordered my usual long black to go, please. Guess I don't have to say that anymore, I said. To go. He seemed serious and matter-of-factly said, no, you don't. I guess what I'm trying to say is that things are changing every day. We're getting a new norm, and that new norm is that nothing is normal, except our stories. I apologize in advance for the sound quality of this recording. Normally, I use an app which records right onto the phone, but as it were, Em and Andrew are trapped in Peru, and all they have is WhatsApp. So please enjoy.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, we'll just have to do it this way.
Sure.
So, my name's Emily Brown.
describe it. I'm on my honeymoon with my husband. And, yeah, so we've been traveling for the past 8 months.
Yeah, thereabouts, 8 months.
8 months. And so we were waiting. My niece had plans to come visit us in April. So we were waiting for that to come home, but when we found out about the way things were going, we cancelled our ticket and booked flights home, and then the day before we booked flights home, the border closed.
So if you didn't hear that, the border closed. And you might think that's like Australia. It's not. In Peru and a few other South American countries, they closed the border from the inside as well as out. So you can't get in like Australia. But you can't get out as well.
We had flights out for the 16th.
17th.
The 17th, sorry. And then on the 15th, Peru announced that they were closing their borders. And DFAT were like, no, that won't affect their flight. Everything's fine. And then we woke up the next morning and we had 20 missed calls. And they're like, no, Peru's closed their border in and out. So that morning we booked a flight to Colombia. That was going to go from Colombia to Chile, and then we could get our normal flight that stopped over in Chile and just wait in the airport for the 24 hours. But unfortunately, by the time we got to the airport on the morning of the 16th, Colombia had closed their borders effective immediately.
Within 20 minutes of us leaving the hotel, they just closed their borders.
You might be thinking to yourself, what a nightmare. But there's more.
We've seen people leave every day since we've got here.
Countries have been getting their people out, and the Australian government, every time we ask, is just saying they're having difficulties, there's diplomacy issues, but just they're issues that only the Australian government seems to be having.
Israel flew their people out within 3 days for free.
Mexico did it within 2 days.
Yeah,
Canada's already working on getting all of their people out.
Yeah, Canada's had three flights in and out, all based on needs. Same with UK, their first flight out was yesterday. It's all needs based, and it was £150.
Salt on the wound. You're not only trapped, but you're watching those around you leave. And you might start asking yourself, what did I do wrong?
There's a flight that goes out on Sunday that we should be on, but that's a private flight that costs $5,000 AED per person that Andrew's parents paid for. That's really hopeful, but for everyone that's either not in Lima or Cusco, or that is...
Can't afford it.
That can't afford it, they're essentially stranded because the government
is refusing to fly people home. If you can't pay for this flight to get back to Australia, then you just have to wait for the commercial flights to...
Resume.
They're stranded here until... Well, indefinitely, really.
The Australian government has told these Australian nationals to find their own way home. To either pay prices like these $5,000 flights, or wait until normal flights resume. But we don't know when that will be. A bigger issue is for those who aren't in the two major cities, where all international flights leave from.
So there was an Australian couple, they're out near the border, up against Peru and Chile, I believe. And it's just a small little kind of, town out in the sticks. And they had limited food, limited water, they're just stranded there and they're not allowed to leave because of the travel restrictions. Every time they try and leave, they get turned back by the military that's in the area, the police, they can't go anywhere.
There's over 300 Australians stuck in different towns, and there's one commercial flight that's stopping at the two main cities. For anyone that's not in these cities, there's just no hope.
Yikes. It's just unimaginable. Something that's more relatable, though, is this idea of financial burden. There are different ways of being imprisoned, and mountains of debt is one of them.
I don't know how we're going to pay Andrew's parents back because we don't have the money, and we can't access Centrelink over here. I'm angry at the government because it's their job to protect us. We're staying at the second cheapest hostel in Lima, and we just paid about 400 AUD for the past 15 days.
And that's not including the lunches that we're paying for. That's not including food.
That's not like.
So.
We're extremely lucky because there are a lot of people that are doing it tough, even here.
As we wrap up our talk, I brought up another story that had received some international media attention.
So we actually heard today that there's an American that posted in, like, an American consulate group saying people from my hostel of over 100 people have tested positive with the coronavirus, and they're telling us that we will be here for between 1 and 3 months. The military won't let us leave the hostel. We're not even allowed to leave our rooms. And now there are flights coming out, and because somebody else in their same hostel has the coronavirus, they're not even eligible to try to get these flights. They're being held in isolation. They don't have any option, and then there is no means of welfare.
Even being imprisoned is pretty expensive, it seems. One thing I'll end on, and something I've noticed that's definitely a theme in almost everyone I talk to. They don't think they have it bad. They know it could be worse. And I find that amazing. And if Em and Andrew don't have it bad, isn't it possible? We all have it pretty good.
So.
We're extremely lucky because there are a lot of people that are doing it tough, even here.
My name is Kate, and this is This Australian Life. Thank you so much for listening. In this episode, episode 10, we had Cherie sharing with us her life story as a teacher and an artist. And lastly, Em and Andrew, two Australians trapped in Peru. Please be well. Reach out if you need to. My email is thisaustralianlife@joy.org.au. Catch you later.
Let's find the feeling once again. Cause maybe you and I just can't be friends. Oh yeah, let's ride the freeway till the end. When loving is so good you can't pretend. I know I left you hanging, but I'ma right my wrongs. I'ma write your love letters like I wrote this song. Gonna put a plan together. Again.